I'm Nick Spitzer. This is American Roots.
Mother-in-law, 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 mother-in-law.
The worst person I know.
Mother-in-law,
mother-in-law. Oh, she worries me so.
Mother-in-law,
mother-in-law. If she leave us alone, oh, we would have a happy home sent from down below.
Mother-in-law,
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 mother-in-law.
The lead singer on that huge 1961 hit from New Orleans is the late Ernie Cato. The flamboyant Cato was a songwriter, roots performance artist, radio host, and club operator. As part of the holiday mood, we've got to look back at Ernie Cato's life of songs and soul surrealism, joined by Ben Sandmel, author of Ernie Cato, the R&B Emperor of New Orleans.
His father was a Baptist preacher in Pointe-Coupe Parish, and he sang in his father's church choir. He spent a lot of time with his mother's relatives in Baton Rouge. He sang in the church choir there, and he sang in the church choir here in New Orleans. Cato was also exposed to the down-home swamp blues sound of Baton Rouge, artists such as Lightnin' Slim, who was kind of his father figure in a way, and also Slim Harpo. And I think you hear that edge in his music, along with the sophistication of New Orleans in terms of the horn charts that Alan Toussaint wrote for his records. And there's an outtake of Mother-in-Law, Cato's big hit, that's twice as fast as the original version.
Mother-in-law, take five.
Mother-in-law,
mother-in-law.
Toussaint had to talk Cato into a more mellow approach, and I think it's a good thing that he did. If they'd released the fast version of Mother-in-Law, it would have worked musically, but people wouldn't have had time to really savor the caustic, sardonic lyrics.
Well, everybody in America that heard that song kind of grew up practicing Mother-in-Law.
Yes, yes. It's funny because that is the phrase that everyone remembers, the phrase that you just sang, and yet that's not Cato's voice on the hook. And that was by the backup singer, Benny Spellman. And when Mother-in-Law became a big hit, Benny Spellman really felt that it was his record because he had, in fact, created the hook that everyone still remembers today. And he demanded co-credit and a big raise. And apparently the next time they were in the studio together, they got in a fist fight. And Alan Toussaint had to send them both home for the day.
I come home with my pay.
At what point does Cato goes into costumery and his sort of extreme public personality, heralding himself? How does that evolve?
In his early days, in the 60s, when he was successful, in those days, his presentation and his demeanor were pretty conventional. And he wore a black suit, you know, white shirt and tie and everything. And after Mother-in-Law did not yield any more hits, and Cato had some very terrible decades of poverty and foreclosure and living on the streets, he came back in the early 1980s and was given a show. He was made the DJ on WWOZ.
The local community radio
station. The local
station.
Community yeah. radio station. And it's at that point that his eccentric persona came out.
Bun, Cato Bun, this is WWOZ radio station, 90.7 on your radio dial.
And he was no longer the conventional performer. He was the shamelessly narcissistic, self-promoting egomaniac.
But I am what I am. I am awesome. I'm so awesome, sometimes I scare my own self.
And he would mostly play his own records and scream over them about what a genius he was. But he would also play his friends' records and scream about what geniuses they were, artists such as Johnny Adams. And it was a very entertaining show, unless you were one of the people who found it really annoying.
Oh my goodness, Johnny Adams, Johnny Hey, Johnny, come on and do it. Johnny Adams, y'all.
Cato ranted and raved about being born at Charity Hospital. He actually was born at an earlier incarnation, not quite the same building. But that didn't stop him, and he was very bullish about Charity Hospital.
The second Monday, 22nd day of 1936, Charity Hospital was about to almost fall down. The nurses and the doctors and everybody went to screaming and yelling, said, what is wrong this morning? Somebody come off of Tulane Avenue and ran in there and told the people and told the doctors and everybody, say, shut up! Don't you know there's a boy, a child being born this morning?
Why was he so into his Charity Hospital birth? He talks about it his whole life on the air and everywhere.
That was one of the many things that he never explained. He also never explained why he used Naugahyde as a code word for sexuality. I think his love of Charity Hospital was part of his general self-adulation, and I think he was very grateful for the government to have provided a facility where poor people with no resources could go get medical care. And that was a big deal in the 30s, just coming out of the Depression. But I think he also saw it as a comparable place of importance to a certain manger in Bethlehem some 2,000 years ago. It's the place where he arrived. And thus, it's important. Anything associated with him was important. So I think it's both his own cult of personality and his identification as a working-class person with no money who nevertheless got good health care and became successful. And he was very proud of that.
Can't name him number one thing, Ernie Cato. Mr. Naugahyde the himself, a bad motor scooter. Mr. Collins can tell you that I am what I am. And I promise you that. Burn Cato, burn!
WWOZ eventually took him off the air, and that really threw him off, and he sank even deeper into alcoholism. And he was sleeping under the Claiborne Bridge, and it seemed he might die in that condition. Then, beautiful love story, beautiful hero's odyssey, redemption story. His second wife, Antoinette Fox, just about literally picked him up out of the gutter and got him to cut way back on his drinking, if not stop altogether, and opened the mother-in-law lounge.
I have a certain girl now that would stand up to me and say what she want to say, and I tell her what I want to say, because she has her mind and I has my mind. And maybe that's why me and her got married.
He gets his own club with Antoinette, and she's a seamstress, and she starts making these very ornate regal outfits with robes and crowns and capes and plumage. And one night in 1998, Cato just announces that henceforth he will be known as the Emperor of the World.
This is American Roots. I'm Nick Spitzer, and we're talking with Ben Sandmail, who wrote Ernie Cato, the R&B Emperor of New Orleans.
Yes.
And it's a great biography of an amazing figure. To what extent do you think this emperor and all the costumery really relate to New Orleans' life as a carnival town?
Ernie Cato is not an aberration in terms of New Orleans culture. Ernie Cato is a logical extension of New Orleans aesthetic, which finds that the greatest sin is dullness, and that flamboyance is celebrated, that eccentricity is celebrated, individualism celebrated, every day's a holiday, any excuse for a parade. And so he fits right in. He's a larger-than-life character. And also his tradition of braggadocio has some antecedents. Jelly Roll Morton, lavish in his self-praise.
That my mother and father, they made a monster when they made me. Don't be ashamed, say I'm a charity baby. Look at me. I look good. I dress good. I dance good. I sing good. I do everything good. My name's spelled K-D-O-E.
It's almost an art form of bragging.
It is an art form of bragging. And in both cases, there's a kernel of truth to it because they were both good. But certainly, Jelly Roll Morton didn't single-handedly invent jazz. And Ernie Cato was not the baddest motor scooter in the universe. But they both had a lot of confidence. Many people whom I interviewed for the book compared Cato to Muhammad Ali. And their styles were different. Their cadences were different. But the overwhelming self-confidence of their pronouncements was very much in the same mode.
Tain is the truth. Yeah. Tain is the truth. She love you. Go on and have a good ride.
Because of his coronating himself the emperor and locking a reporter from the New York Times in the club and some of his various pronouncements when he, you know, look you dead in the eye and very seriously say that they're getting ready to put his picture on a box of Wheaties. People would focus on that and forget that he really was a great New Orleans R&B singer. And for me, if he had just been a New Orleans R&B singer with one hit record, I don't think that would have been the basis of a book. And if he had just, in this town, been a flamboyant eccentric, that certainly was not unique. That would not set him apart either. But the combination of those two and this dramatic, I really think of it as a hero's odyssey, apart from music, it just to me was a very compelling story.
Tracking the Ernie Cato performance legacy with biographer Ben Sandmel. More scenes from the life of Cato in a few minutes. But first, one of his great songs, sung by soul queen Irma Thomas, I Done Got Over It, on American Roots.
One day I couldn't stop crying. Tears kept on flowing, the pain in my heart kept on bleeding, but I love you. I give you my heart, I give you my soul now. It was you I adore. Oh, I done got over. Never be found.
Ernie Cato, 1960, with a song written by producer Alan Toussaint, who also went by the name Naomi Neville, a legal nom de plume. It was his mother's maiden name. We are back to conclude the unparalleled life of New Orleans R&B emperor, Ernie Cato, when American Roots returns.